Patties, the champions of Montreal.
Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah Day, recording from home on Thursday, June 17th, 2021. On tonight's show, more conversations from the 30th Annual Fringe Festival. My guest tonight, storyteller Nisha Coleman of All Right, Solving the Problem of Living.
That was my goal with this show, Solving the Problem of Living. It's talking about struggling with being alive and coming to terms with being alive so that you can live better. Because once you accept, okay, I'm alive, I will accept to live.
Justin Kalla and Julia Kennefic of The Space Between, a story about ghostly friends.
Not only are we kind of resurrecting live theater here, but also just, you know, getting back in touch with people and getting back to these connections that, you know, might not have been, not discarded, but put on hold while everybody has been dealing with so much from the outside world that's been going on.
Musician Ali Wei with the Choral Poetry Project.
I really do intend for it to be a soothing experience and a reflective and a deep experience, and for people not to be bombarded or particularly surprised. That's not what I'm aiming for. I'm aiming for people to feel connected to themselves and to what's happening in the room.
We are headed into the final weekend of the 30th Annual Montreal Fringe Festival. With just a few shows to go and limited seating, many are notching sold-out runs, with over $30,000 in ticket sales so far. You'll recall that all the proceeds go directly to the artist or artists who set their own ticket price, with a few dollars each going to cover the fest's overhead. The Fringe is still soliciting donations to help pay the bills, as there is no Fringe Park, aka beer and food sales, to help pad out the budget this year. You can become a friend of the fest anytime this month. Find out more at montrealfringe.ca. And if you want to learn more about the history of the festival, consider tuning in to the Fringe Buzz Lab, a bilingual podcast I am co-hosting with the talented Véronique Raymond handling the episodes in French. It really sounds like an oral history of the festival, with interviews with the very first founders and artists who made their careers at the Fringe. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcasts. Keywords are Lab Fringe Buzz. Another one of my episodes just dropped today, and it includes a chat with Pat Donnelly, who is a longtime arts journalist at the Montreal Gazette, who was there for the very first festival back in 1991. So there are a few more days left in the Fringe. Live shows continue until this Sunday, June 20th. But if you still have a craving for some kooky content, the myriad offerings at Fringe TV will still be up until June 30th. And one of those shows is titled All Right, Solving the Problem of Living, written and performed by Nisha Coleman, one of our city's most gifted storytellers. Nisha is a petite person with a soft, almost ethereal voice, but the stories she weaves are delightful and intricate, heart-stopping, and yet deeply humorous. In her work for the Moth Story Hour and CBC, and in solo shows like Things Drugs Taught Me, she's taking us through her freewheeling but fraught childhood and her time busking in Paris. Her solo show, Self Exile, won Best English Production at the Montreal Fringe in 2016. You can get your latest dose of Nisha in All Right, a virtual show filmed over several months where the raconteuse shares new stories about life, mental health, and hope. And she does it all from a tree, as you are about to hear. I spoke with Nisha earlier this week. A heads up that we do address suicide about 10 minutes into the conversation. Feel free to take a break for about 5 minutes if you need to. Welcome to Upstage, Nisha. It's so nice to speak with you. How are you doing?
I'm great, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
You are a really talented storyteller. So I just wanted to start off by saying it's so nice to be able to see you perform again. And also on demand, whenever I want.
That's right. You can stop me. You can start me.
Nisha, you're someone who
you've shared so many aspects of your life with so many audiences, and not just in Montreal, but you've traveled, you've spoken on the Moth Radio Hour, you've spoken on the CBC. What is a pandemic like for someone who is a professional storyteller?
Well, at first it was discombobulating because all of a sudden there was no audience anymore, and no real idea when we would be able to return to theaters. That said, pretty quickly, a fair number of storytelling shows went online and they would ask me to participate. And at first I thought, what's the point? I don't see the value in performing in front of a screen. I don't have the audience's energy, their reactions, their laughter, their gasps. And those are the things that fuel me as a storyteller. And so I honestly didn't think it would work. And I was not pitching my stories to these shows. But whenever anyone asked me to participate, I didn't say no. And so I pretty quickly discovered that this format works very well for the online platform. It was quite actually delightful to learn that pretty soon after things locked down, because it provided a way for us to keep connecting. And there were things that we could do online that we couldn't do in a theater, such as react in real time in the chat. Right. So you can hear people, not hear, but you can hear their voices as you read their reactions in the chat in real time, or read them after your story and just see what moments they were connecting to, what phrases, and people that might not have come up to you after a performance in a theater are less shy to put what they thought or how they felt into the chat. So it was actually a really cool experience to be able to connect with my audience in a brand new way, and in some ways, a more intimate way.
That is so fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of thinking about stand-up comedians and how performing on Zoom has been a bit of a barrier, because it's harder to kind of interact with the audience, maybe pick on someone in the front row, and they're reading comments to like try to build that rapport. And that's really crucial to that style of performance. But for you as a storyteller, to read through, you were saying that you read comments after you had finished like a performance, and then you would kind of be able to interact. Like, that was a richer experience than what you would normally have.
It was. And also I can put, if it's on Zoom, I can choose gallery view, so I'm not staring at my own face.
Yeah.
The first time I made the mistake of not doing that, so I just saw my own face, and it was very off-putting to perform to just myself. Yeah. But then I put the gallery view, and I could see people's reactions more than I would in a dark theater with bright lights in my face. So that was another interesting thing, to just see people smiling and laughing and reacting, just their facial expressions.
Okay, so you've mastered the art of storytelling on Zoom. The Fringe Festival rolls around and your performance is on demand as part of Fringe TV. Did you consider doing a live performance, or did you always want to do something that would be viewed online?
Well, as soon as things started to shut down, I made an effort to pivot to the online platform with my show. So I contacted my director, Stephen McLean Rogers, and said, would you be interested in doing something digital? Because I didn't want to wait until theaters were open again. I did not know that The Fringe would have a TV option on demand, but all I knew is that I wanted to get the show into the world somehow. So we worked together virtually, and it was a whole other world. We had to use our brains in completely different ways, but it turned out to be quite enriching, and I didn't know what I would do exactly with the finished product. I just knew that I wanted to have it. And so when The Fringe decided that they would have this Fringe TV channel, I was pretty delighted. It was a pretty obvious choice for me to send in the video as opposed to doing the show live on stage. For this iteration,
was the concern kind of that you'd already started working on being online, and so you wanted to make use of this virtual performance, or was it more like not being comfortable with performing in person?
I would have been comfortable. It was more that since we worked so hard to prepare it for the digital world, we would have had to go back to the drawing board and sort of rework the entire show to get it ready for the stage. Okay. Because there really are, the process was so different. And so it was a time constraint. And just the fact that we worked so hard to get this final product filmed in a tree.
Yeah.
So filming in a tree is a whole other experience as well. There were so many hindrances, such as wind and weather and just my own stamina. And so that took so much effort. And it was filmed over 3 seasons, not because I wanted to film it over 3 seasons, but because that's how long it actually took to do it, because there were so many things getting in my way, or just so many roadblocks along the way.
Yes, I want to get to the tree. I'm speaking with Nisha Coleman, acclaimed storyteller, now starring in All Right, Solving the Problem of Living, now available on Fringe TV. So yes, so you this is so fascinating. There's a tree. Tell me about the tree. Where is it located, and why did you end up choosing this one to start this show with?
Well, it took a while to figure out that I wanted to do it in a tree. At first, we just knew it will be digital. I thought I could do it in my apartment. I could do it in bed. I could do it upside down. I didn't know. I was just playing with ideas. But there's this one beautiful tree where I was staying in Canada, outside of Ontario. And it's part of the Greenbelt. So it's public land. There's sort of a path nearby. But there's this giant, you know, hundreds of years old oak tree. And I would pass it and just stare at its glory and want to climb it, because it had these huge, thick, inviting branches. And one day it just made the most sense. It was like a eureka moment. Like, Of course, that's where I will do the show. It will be recorded in the tree. Because it had this perfect sort of, we called it the cradle, where halfway up the tree, there were about 5 different branches that converged in this sort of like nest area that was pretty secure. Like, I wasn't afraid I would fall out, and I could secure the camera to different branches to have different angles and different heights. So playing with camera angles and being, you know, close or far away from the camera, all these different possibilities that the tree brought forth.
Did you name the tree? Did the tree develop its own persona just in spending so much time with it?
Well, I call it my tree. Before I did the show, and before I even had the idea to do it in the tree, me and my partner called it the talking tree, just because it seemed to be communicating somehow. It by itself, not even, you know, through me. I should send you a picture of it. Just
I was just going to say that I am looking at a photo of you in the tree, and you can kind of see the 5 branches. Would we, mm-hmm. if we went to your socials at Nisha Coleman, we would be able to see it before viewing the show?
Yeah, you know what? I'm going to upload a photo of the tree from far away.
Okay.
At the opening of the show, you can see me climbing the tree. So you get a sense of just how big it is and how high I am. So that's the opening of the show, is just this climbing sequence. But it is quite a glorious sight just to see this, you know, flourishing oak tree, the leaves just lit up by the sun. And it's just such an inviting scene.
And I can't help but wonder, you were saying that, you know, there were delays and things would get in your way, and so this is why it took so long to film it. But having this oak tree through 3 different seasons, I'm sure also kind of in some philosophical way for you must have represented the passage of time, the taking mm-hmm. of time to create something.
Yeah, there were so many ways that nature participated in this show, and that's what I wanted to happen. You know, a flock of birds would just come into the tree. There were squirrels, caterpillars, and of course wind, weather, and yeah, seeing the tree change and morph over time certainly helped with the thematic element of the show, of growth and change and accepting change and all of those things.
You're hearing from Nisha Coleman, acclaimed storyteller and the star of All Right, Solving the Problem of Living. Wonderful title. It reminds me of self-help or something philosophical that I might read. I like self-help, and I like thinking about things in terms of solutions and fixing things. You get into some heady territory here. We're talking about dealing with mental health, and as you were saying, all being all right with being alive. Why did you choose to go in this direction for this production?
I knew that my next show was going to be about suicide in some way. I've just been touched by suicide in so many different ways, from growing up with a suicidal father to losing a friend to suicide to saving a stranger from suicide. I feel like it's a part of all of our lives. It's something that we don't know how to talk about yet. And I find that the most upsetting of all is that we sometimes are not able to talk about these really important subjects. We're worried about triggering people. It's a valid concern.
Right.
But I find also that having it be so taboo can be quite damaging for someone struggling with suicide ideation, for example. To open up the gate and allow for such conversations, what I hope is that it will allow people to be real and feel free to talk about what they're going through. Especially in this last year, many people have experienced mental illness that have never experienced it before. And if you have had issues with mental illness, quite often it's been aggravated over the last year. Suicide rates have increased. I think it's something we can't shy away from. It needs to be treated delicately. And so it was hard. It was hard to go to those tricky territories and treat it as delicately as I could while being honest. And interspersing it with stories of living and connection, because the thing for me that brings all of these stories together is how we really need each other, and not just our friends and not just our family, but strangers. There's a lot of moments in this story where strangers come out of nowhere and help me, or I'm the stranger helping someone else. And so I think it's not just our friends that we need to rely upon and our families, but we're just a network of humans, and we can help anyone at any time or reach out for help from anyone at any time. So that was my goal with this show, Solving the Problem of Living. It's talking about struggling with being alive and coming to terms with being alive so that you can live better. Because once you accept, okay, I'm alive, I will accept to live, then there's sort of a change in perception. And I think it can allow us to live better and deeper and fuller lives.
One last question for you, Nisha. You've never shied away from difficult topics, and you've talked about your upbringing and your finding your way through life. Do you feel that what we've lived through, the pandemic, this really kind of pushed this idea of being alive and finding help, did that push it to the forefront for you in terms of a topic you needed to present to the public?
Yeah, and that's really the main reason why I wanted to push this show forward by any means that I could. And so using the digital was the only option I had. So I didn't know how I would do it, but I knew that it needed to be out in the world in case that was something that people needed to witness or listen to, and give them an opportunity to share their own experiences. The first time that we did this performance, it was a it was like a watch party, an online watch party, and we had quite a long and detailed talk back at the end where people could share what they'd lived, how they've been feeling, how they deal with their own mental illnesses, and learning to accept where we are in this moment. So maybe we're struggling, but the resistance to the struggle only makes it worse. So one thing that was really interesting in the talk back was this idea of accepting where we are in this moment, even if that means we're struggling. Okay, we're struggling. And we might not struggle forever. We won't struggle forever. But it's okay to admit I'm struggling. That's okay.
Nisha, I'm sure this is going to help and soothe a lot of people. I thank you for your candor today, and I really appreciate your work. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
That was storyteller Nisha Coleman discussing her show, All Right, Solving the Problem of Living. You can stream Nisha's play on Fringe TV, the virtual platform for the 30th Festival, available online until June 30th. Visit montrealfringe.ca and purchase your ticket to get access. And you can check out her work at nishacoleman.com. I'm Sarah DeA, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. We are deep into Fringe coverage with just a few days left at the fest. Still to come in this hour, five women, five poems, and a soothing 35 minutes, the Choral Poetry Project. But for now, I'd like you to meet Gail, a young woman who has lost her best friend from childhood. But how to connect with him when he's dead? Gail turns to Gwyn for help, a uniter of souls. In The Space Between, a new production and first Fringe show by Phantom Limb Theater Company. It's a friendly yet spooky paranormal romp with young actors, and it's playing now at Studio Hydro-Québec at Monument National on the Main. I spoke with Julia Kennefic, who describes her character, Gwyn, as a spooky witch girl, the leader of the Ghost Club. I also spoke with the man behind the story, playwright and director Justin Calla. This is our conversation from earlier this week about The Space Between.
Welcome to Upstage, Julia and Justin. So nice to have you here. How are you both doing today?
Excellent. I'm doing great. Yeah, thanks for having us.
Very, very good. Yeah, thank you so much.
So the first weekend has already happened, and you have a couple more shows ahead. Julie, I understand being back on stage for the first time in a while. How did that go?
Yeah, it was definitely a bit of a transition for sure. I think that I was just so excited to be back doing live theater that I totally forgot about those first night jitters. So I'm usually not too much of a stage fright person. I usually am just super excited, but I definitely had a bad case of the whole body vibrating on opening night, which I guess is normal. So definitely felt a little bit shaky taking off on opening night, but I think once we got to night two, everything was sitting in the body a little bit better. So yeah, a lot of fun. Definitely a lot of fun.
It looks like a really fun show, but I want to ask Justin, for you as the writer, the progenitor, the director, opening night, like what is that for you, like especially in this time?
I mostly have just been so excited to see everything come together. Like it has been a Olympian effort of coordination between everybody to get the show together, and having it all come together like night one, you know, me running around backstage trying to get props in place because we don't have, you know, anybody. I'm the props person de facto. Yeah, just trying to get everything set the way it has to be, and you know, we have such a short time to load in and load out. I've definitely been focused on the technical side a lot more since we stopped stopped with the rehearsals proper anyway. It has, it's just been so exciting. Oh my God. And listening to the first couple laughs that we got in the audience, I think it was during your monologue at the beginning there, Julia. Just so exciting and so much fun and just so good to be back.
So if this sounds like a really fun ghost story, has this a ghost story, something that you've always wanted to work on, or I'm trying to figure out your inspiration here.
I really love ghost stories. I'm not big into horror movies, mind you. I don't have the stomach for them all the time. But ghosts absolutely some of my favorite stories. Particularly, I really love the stage version of The Woman in Black. I think it's a West End show to start with. It was a short story beforehand, but yeah, just like such an interesting experience bringing that kind of atmosphere into a theatrical setting versus, you know, on film. Like you're really in it in a completely different way, and that's super powerful, I think. Of course, this isn't quite as, you know, spooky as something like The Woman in Black. It's not a horror play so much, but it definitely has those elements that I think hopefully it has drawn people to come to see the show, and yeah, it gets people excited.
So more, I'm thinking like a Casper vibe. That's the movie I always think to when I think of friendly ghosts, as opposed to something like The Exorcist, which is like designed to shock you.
Yeah, that's Casper for sure. So a couple of friendly ghosts in this one and some unfriendly ghosts too.
I'd love to get into the atmosphere in just a moment, but we'll bring back Julia here. You're playing the character of Gwyn, who you've both described her as the leader of the ghost club, or the spooky witch girl. She meets someone named Gail, our protagonist, someone who's recently gone through a loss.
Yeah, exactly. So they kind of have a happenstance meeting, or a meet cute on the bus where their paths kind of cross. And yeah, Gwyn sees someone who is right in the middle of kind of receiving this big loss. And as someone who has experienced loss in her life herself, reaches out to Gail and kind of wants her to experience what it's like to be able to communicate with that person, right? So Gwyn says, okay, I've met this person that has experienced loss. I have a way that I want to share with this person in order to allow them to still feel connected to the person that they've just lost. So it's a very empathetic move for her, I think, although there is a lot of spookiness to it, the great beyond and all that. I think for her, the way that she sees that is as a method of communication and connection that can help with grief and with closure.
Can you describe to me what your character, how she presents, and what your costume looks like?
Oh man, would I love to, Sarah. So I actually joked when I first went for the Gwyn fitting. I was like, oh my God, this is what 19-year-old me thought I looked like, but like she actually looks that cool. So yeah, I mean, my first outfit, I've got these fishnets, and I have these really cool like 32 eyelet like witchy boots that I get to wear, this like black mini skirt, Susie Sue t-shirt, which I'm definitely keeping after the show if Jess will the costume designer will be so nice to let me keep it, awesome black wig. I get to wear a great smoky eye. We had a great lipstick too, unfortunately, because of the ongoing pandemic and the requirements for masks within Quebec's venues. That's all you get to see, but I do try to make it that you can definitely see what's going on up there. Some awesome jewelry. It's the kind of style that like I would never in a million years wear out in public, but it's just so great. And I remember the first rehearsal that we did, it brought out so much physicality and so much more of the character. It's such a joy as an actor and as a performer to get to that point in the process where you've done all kind of this mental work on the character, and then you get to put on the garb and it's like, okay, she's here.
It sounds like so much fun, and it's awesome when your character really helps you take that final step towards like really embodying it, right?
Absolutely.
I'm speaking with Julia Kenefick, who's playing the role of Gwyn, and also playwright and director Justin Calla of The Space Between, a ghost story, a fun ghost story. Tell me a bit about the atmosphere, because I'm curious about this. We've talked about how it's supernatural, but it's also not like scare you out of your seat. How do you bring that atmosphere into the space?
I think a lot of it kind of comes down to, yeah, like first of all, like the aesthetic, as Julia, as you guys touched on there a moment ago, really been strongly brought to life in the costumes, obviously, like performances of the actors influence that. We've been talking a lot about like the grandioseness that these characters see in the mysticism of all of this, and like how important it is to them, not only because it's supernatural, but because it's a way for them to connect, and it's a way for them to deal with loss in their lives. My girlfriend, actually, Jess Byer, is the costume designer. She's done an amazing job on every single costume in this. And Miles, our lighting designer and stage manager. At last minute, we didn't have the ability to access the space until our tech rehearsal, which was just last week. My God, it feels like years ago, but just last week. So we had about 3 hours to put everything together, and they came just so well prepared. I didn't know what anything was going to look like, but we got it done so fast. It was, yeah, like I was saying earlier, a feat of coordination between everybody. I would say that the atmosphere, we try to strike a really strong balance between the creepiness, the sorrow, the loss, but also, like, you know, the levity. The show's about moving past all of that and into kind of more of an understanding with these sort of things. There's quite a bit of humor in the show as well. And more even than I expected, I think, while writing it. We got a couple good laughs out of it. It's been so great.
Yeah, you've said that this is about finding light in dark moments. We also have Gail, Leia's character, who is missing her childhood best friend. And coming slowly out of this pandemic, I think people are mourning not only loved ones who actually have been lost, especially here in Quebec, where we've had a really high mortality rate from COVID, but also just we've mourned a lot of parts of our lives that we've missed. I'm sure for both of you, you've missed doing theater and being around friends. Was any of that thinking imbuing any meaning into, you know, as you were doing rehearsals and discussing and maybe writing the roles, the characters in the play, for both of you, was any of that playing a role in what you were thinking, where your mind was at?
Not only are we kind of resurrecting live theater here, but also just, you know, getting back in touch with people and getting back to these connections that, you know, might not have been, not discarded, but put on hold while everybody has been dealing with so much from the outside world that's been going on. So, the play is very much about connection, and I think that the more that we can let people in, generally, the happier that we are, and I think it speaks to that in a meaningful way. I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. So we often joke that this show is very cat heavy. there's multiple dead cats involved, you know, spirits of dead cats involved. And while I'm working on the show, over the weekend, my family lost our family dog. He passed away on Saturday night. And it hit me a lot harder than I think I expected. Just given, I think, just all everything that we've all had to carry around this past year, and just being that I was so far away from my family. And so I was doing some reading on grief and you know, what kind of place that has in our lives. And I read this very interesting way of talking about moving forward with grief and the idea of growing around the grief. So it's not that the grief in its size ever decreases or goes away, but that we can instead hold space for that grief and expand our life around it. And I think that this show makes space for the grief for its characters and shows a way forward while still respecting the loss. And I think that we can look at that in so many different ways. I mean, I think there's such a need and a move back to normalcy, right? That's something that we hear everybody talk about all the time. But I think that being able to hold space for the grief and the loss while understanding that we can still have joy and move forward and make more space is really important. I think that's something that we really see in this show.
Well, I'm so sorry. It's so well put. And I'm also so sorry to hear about your dog. It's
Thank
always
you.
Hard when you've had a family.
Yeah. I keep waking up and forgetting. And then 15 minutes later, I'm like, oh, that just sucks. Sucks so bad.
Where is your family? Yeah.
They're in just outside of Toronto in Oakville, Ontario. Mm-hmm. So not like close enough that in non-pandemic times I can hop on a train or they're really close, but definitely far enough away, especially because the borders have been closed between the provinces for so long, the land border, that I haven't seen my family since Christmas, and I haven't seen my older sister in a year. So it's you know, I think that it's just important to remember that we cannot have light without darkness. I know that's so deep for a French show, right? But it is true. And I think that it's so important that we have spaces and shows and art that reflect both of those things and how they can't exist without the other.
Yeah. I'm sure if this was normal times, your family would be like spending a couple of days in Montreal just to come see you.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, yeah. So they were definitely very bummed. But I'm sure this won't be the last time that Justin and I work together. So they'll have other chances.
Certainly hope not.
Yes. And Justin, just to get started on the next piece, anytime you're ready. One last quick question for you. I'm speaking with Justin Kalla, writer and director of The Space Between, and one of his performers, Julia Kenefic. Being at Monument National, Studio Hydro-Québec, it's kind of a newish venue. I can't remember in my fringe history. I should ask somebody, but in my fringe history, I haven't seen anything there. Just curious quickly to know what being in that space is like, because it's a big, beautiful old building, and it's not like a hole in the wall as some of our other venues have been in the past.
I love it. It's one of the best venues I've ever been in. It strikes such a great note between kind of gritty and industrial, but also like it's very like clean and nice and well put together. And Justin, as probably someone who's more used to being on the side of looking for venues, and you probably have more to say, but like I just really like being in there. The energy is really good, and it's cool, which during the summer is really important.
Especially if you have how many holes, how many laces to do up in your boots?
Yeah, 32. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the AC definitely helps. The show is set in October, so you're wearing a big jacket in that first scene. Leia,
yeah,
I think, never changes. Yeah, I don't think she changes out of a sweater for the whole entire show. Yeah, that's definitely nice. It's an amazing venue. Oh my God, and I love that all of like the passes backstage are like, there's an actual wall there, so you're not so much worried about hitting curtains, doing any of that kind of thing, and it just, yeah. Says, yeah, it's helped everything. We've been very lucky that it's helped everything come together in the way that it has.
Beautiful. Well, it sounds like you guys have had a blast putting this together. You still have a couple more shows left, and I can tell you're going to have a great time. Really appreciate your time, Justin and Julia.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having us.
Of course, anytime. Looking forward to the next one.
That was Julia Kenefic, who plays the role of Gwyn, and director and playwright Justin Kalla. Their show, The Space Between, continues until Sunday at the Monument National as part of The Fringe. Visit their company, Phantom Limb Theater Company, on Facebook and Instagram. And for tickets and more information, montrealfringe.ca, or call 514-849-FEST. I'm Sarah DeAy, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. We are deep into Fringe coverage with just a few days left at the festival. I've checked out a few things online at the festival, including Wretch and also a short piece by Home Theater Productions that involves new spins on old fables. And in terms of in-person shows, I've seen Knife Fight X with Walter Ling, as well as the Choral Poetry Project, which brings me to my final interview for the evening. Let's start with the Choral Poetry Project by looking at the numbers. 5 choral pieces inspired by 5 poems sung by 5 singers in one space. It's been so long since we've been treated to live music, especially singing during the pandemic, and that's partly what makes the project such a treat. It's a short show, but soothingly impactful and beautiful to watch. Storyteller and musician Ellie Wei wrote the choral settings. She sings alongside Avery Gates, Samantha Lowe Monaco, LV Dalgard, and Melanie Carriage, and Ali's partner Luke Jason Murphy takes care of the musical interludes. Ali has performed at the Fringe before, but not quite like this. She and I spoke earlier this week. Ali walked me through the 5 poems and the lengths to which her team had to go to practice their singing safely. Welcome, Ali Wei, back to Upstage. So nice to speak with you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
You're coming off a strong first weekend at the Fringe Festival. I think for a lot of people, this will be the first time that they've been back inside mainline theater in over a year. How special is it for you to be in the black box space at mainline?
It is so special and so intimate and so different too, because of social distancing and the audience. They're not clumped together, they're spread out in the room, but it's still very, very intimate. And the voice, it's primarily a vocal performance, and the voice is so intimate and vibrational, and we feel the audience too. And it's really just being bodies all in the same inside room together, and then with the magic of lighting and all of that, it's just been fantastic. And the first night, Amy Blackmore asked me permission, which of course I gave, for her to say hello to everybody and welcome them back, and she cried. It was so sweet on opening night to share that moment together. Like our show was the very first show in Mainline since before the pandemic, so wow. It's been really special.
No pressure, right? To deliver a great performance after kind of this emotional return for so many audience members. Mm-hmm. You were telling me that it's this kind of an experiment for you to be working on the choral poetry project. I don't have a lot of background with choral work, and you pointed out by the sheer size that it's kind of an experiment. So what would the normal size of a choral group be?
Well, the pieces that I've written are it's called in choral lingo SSAA, soprano, soprano, alto, alto. So usually four lines. Sometimes I have five, sometimes I have three. So it's polyphonic music, which means there's harmony, and which means it could mean contrapuntal as well, which is that we're not all singing the same words at the same time. Mm-hmm. And in a choir, basically I've written these pieces for 8 people or 16 people or even 30 people or 32 people, ideally. And you have coverage, because if somebody takes a breath, you don't notice. If somebody loses their spot, you don't notice, because there's so many other people on the same line. But I could only have 5 singers. Mm-hmm. And I decided to go ahead anyway. And I chose singer friends that I have who are all seasoned choristers, but they also can hold a solo line, and they were also available for the tight rehearsal schedule that we had. So I have a really strong team of singers who are able to, they have good breath control, so they don't need to breathe too often, and they also were willing to learn some complicated pieces and basically be alone on their line most of the time.
Right.
And there's a lot of jumping around too. Like I do a lot of jumping around to fill when somebody needs a little extra support on a line, and a few of us are doing that too. So it's that, in that sense, it's an experiment. Like what does music written for a choir sound like with just 5 singers?
And I think for people in the audience who are not familiar with this kind of work, it's almost surprising to know that you could be watching a chorus of 20 people, 25 people, and to realize that someone might, as you were saying, lose the line or have a pause or need to have an intake of breath, because when we see it and hear it, it sounds so flawless. Like that's some of the magic, right? Is hearing this beautiful coming together of so many different voices, but we don't hear necessarily, like without a trained ear, you don't necessarily hear those small changes. And so it's a very almost naked, very bold moment to have just the 5 of you.
It sure is. It's very, very exposing. I think that we effectively do it, and what choristers who have come to see the show have said, the feedback is, it's so interesting for them to be able to hear each individual voice, each individual phrase, each individual person taking a breath, knowing where it's coming from, like because we all have very distinct voices,
right?
And so when a different line comes in, you know whose mouth it came out of, as opposed to when you're watching a choir of 20 or 30 or even 40 people, it's this mass, and you can't always catch where that particular harmony or sound is coming from. But when it's just 5 of us, the audience can really follow, like who's singing what, when, and who's, and probably, you know, if there is a mistake, you're also exposed. So it's intense in that way. Like it's an intense performance for all of us to do. It requires a lot of focus and concentration.
I'm speaking with Ali Wei, who is responsible for the choral settings, the creation of Choral Poetry Project. And of course, she's also performing during the show as well. Now, in the context of coming out of the pandemic that we are in right now, what I think about too is that at the very beginning, realizing that speaking or laughing or singing was a way to propagate the virus. To see people singing live together, it feels special.
Yeah, it's really special. And when we first started rehearsing outside together, it was very emotional for all of us because that was a huge loss. Like anyone who's in a choir knows how good for their mental health it is, how built into their self-care routine it is, how connecting it is, how joyful it is as an activity. And that was such a huge loss when the pandemic hit. And then to also feel like, well, this was an activity that was particularly dangerous because of those things that were in the news. So we didn't know when we were going to be able to sing together again. And with the better weather coming and me finding out I had a spot in the Fringe, we just decided to go for it. We were rained on for a couple of our rehearsals and we just had it because we had this, the show, I found out about my spot and 5.5 weeks later we were performing.
Wow.
I conceived of the show on the first day that I found out. I was on the waiting list and I came up and I got the spot. I conceived of the show. I wrote to these four friend singers. They all said yes within 24 hours. 24 hours later, I send them the Google Drive with all the stuff they have to learn. We're rehearsing within 5 days and then we rehearsed 2 or 3 times a week. No, that's not quite true. We rehearsed about 6 or 7 times total for a lengthy rehearsal outside, but that we were rained on a few times and we were hiding in the church on under the roof at the top of the steps on the big church on Rachel, Saint Jean Baptiste Church, which actually has a nice acoustic, sort of sheltering from the rain and still rehearsing because we had these precious hours to put the show together and we needed to be safe COVID-wise and we couldn't just trash the rehearsal just because it rained. So we kept on going even though it was raining.
So remind us in terms of when you found out that you were waitlisted to opening this month, how much time elapsed?
5.5 weeks.
Wow, and that's remarkable.
I know. And it kind of accounts for, like, I am pretty impressed with us on that front. In 5.5 weeks, we put together a show that I'm really proud of. And it really has a flow to it. It really is an experience from beginning to end. And everybody is bringing their best performance, presence and ability. And it's only 35 minutes long, so the length of the show is really related to the fact that we only had 5.5 weeks to prepare it. But I still think it offers something to audience members, that 35 minutes.
I do want to get into some of the themes and the ideas behind the pieces that you chose and that you worked with. I'm speaking with Ali Wei, who is the creator of the Choral Poetry Project, and she also is performing in it. I wanted to ask before that about getting back together and singing. Was there a learning curve or a getting back into the swing of things? Like, is it possible to, you get out of shape if you don't jog for a while or go to the gym, you know, being kind of shut down for over a year, was there that kind of period where everybody kind of had to tighten up the skills again?
Hell yes. It was surprising. Like, it was so surprising to me having been, I've been a singer for so long and at times I'm singing 9 or 10 hours a week in a regular life. And I was so vocally out of shape. And I think everybody felt the same way. I took a couple of vocal coaching lessons with our beloved Kathy Kennedy, the founder of Carol Maha. So I did a couple of lessons with her to say, because I was like, Kathy, I can't find the voice that I'm used to having. Like I was definitely, the instrument definitely gets out of shape if it's not used. And so I'm not the only one that was seeing their vocal coach on Zoom to prepare. And then we're just, I can hear us getting stronger, getting better vocally as we, even as we perform, you know, in each performance where there's a lot more precision in tuning, a lot more focused sound, breath control, all these things you have to keep in shape. And for sure, because we weren't going to choir practice, or most of us weren't, some people were still doing it over Zoom, people did get out of shape, but we're in shape now.
And yeah, you can absolutely hear it in the show. You drew on the works of five different writers. So there's five pieces, one of which you wrote as well. Can you tell me about some of the themes that you were gathering as you were looking at these pieces, and why, what you were thinking of as you were kind of curating the themes of the songs?
Right. Well, in general, I get inspired by poetry, and sometimes I can already hear the music in a poem that I read. So in the case of the Naomi Shihab Nye poem, If the Shoe Doesn't Fit, that was a song in my head when I read the poem. So then I asked her permission. I sent her a draft of the composition, and she and her husband were through the roof with delight. They absolutely loved it. And she just gave me permission and told her publisher to give me permission to use her poem. So that was how that one happened. And that one's really about being yourself. And if the shoe doesn't fit, you take it off. It's as simple as that. So it's a very short, cute poem that we end the show with. There are two local poets that I worked with. In both of those cases, I had music already, and I was looking for words to go with the music. And so then I collaborated with two amazing women. One of them is a former Kaumaha member as well, Robin Gorn, who's a spoken word artist and musician and singer and poet. And so she and I worked together with her words to fit her words into music I'd already written. And so that was kind of a collaboration. That's the piece called Whole Body Breathing, which opens the show. And then I had a kind of Gregorian chant, but that I took as a springboard and made it to harmony. So the one in French, Vieillam, I don't know if you remember that one, Vieillam.
Yes.
Au cœur d'enfant. And so I made that three-part harmony, which has a lot of dissonance in it and a lot of pauses and a lot of changes in speed of singing. There's a lot of communication that happens in that piece when we perform it. But Véronique Garneau-Allard is a friend of mine who is an amazing spontaneous writer. And so I asked her to write something for that piece, and she just knocked it out of the park. Like the fable that she wrote is so beautiful, called Vieille âme au cœur d'un enfant. And so we also collaborated very carefully. We took like a couple of days together, making sure that she was okay with how the words were placed into the music. And so I changed a few of the rhythms in the music to honor the words. Like, it really was a collaboration. And then Emily Bronte is in the public domain, so I didn't need to ask her permission.
No.
that one is like, it's a very eerie poem, Fall Leaves Fall. It's about yearning for winter. She yearns for that quiet time, that reflective time that winter brings. And she wants the flowers, die flowers away, is one of the lines in the poem. And that was just a moment of musical inspiration when I read the poem. I wanted to put it to music. I've done a Google search, and I'm not the only one that's put that poem. So not surprisingly, I'm not the only one on the planet that has put that music, that poem to music. And then the fifth one is based on my own words about motherhood. It's called Splitting. and inspired by just the experience of being pregnant, giving birth, what it is to be, to love someone into leaving you. That very special kind of love, which is the love that if you're successful, this person is going to walk away from you.
Yeah.
And so that I was trying to capture in the text and the music of Splitting, which is one of the pieces. So yeah, the themes are, it's alienation from self, alienation from from nature, themes of loss and letting go, and about connection too. Whole body breathing, I think, is really about connection to nature and to each other and to our the power that we have within ourselves.
A lot of things that people have been contemplating over the past year and a bit, right? Yeah. Very prescient timing. The really nice thing is that your mom came to see the show just towards the tail end of the weekend, I think. And she was also a choral director.
She was. Yes, my mom, who's 83, whose name is Georgia, started directing choirs. Her mother was a choir director, and then she started directing. So from the age of five, I've been in musical theater and cantatas and church choirs and every kind of choir. So that really started with my mom being a choral director, and she loved the show. And what she loved especially about the show was that the way it's structured is, I really do intend for it to be a soothing experience and a reflective and a deep experience, and for people not to be bombarded or particularly surprised. That's not what I'm aiming for. I'm aiming for people to feel connected to themselves and to what's happening in the room. So I try to do that in a variety of ways. The intro music is me on violin playing themes from the choral pieces. And so there might be a sense of familiarity when you hear the choral piece later in the show that maybe you've kind of heard that before. And we each take a poem and we recite it, and then we sing the poem. So you've already heard the words, and you're not trying to take it all in at once for the, you know, hear, understand what the meaning is, what the words are, and listen to the music. You've already heard the words, and then you hear it done musically. So my mother loved that, because she said, I always get, you know, I'm trying to hear the words and the meaning, and I miss some of the beauty of the music because I'm focusing on hearing the words. But so she was thrilled with the design of the show.
That's so wonderful. Allie, it's been really such a pleasure to speak with you and hear more about your craft and what it's like to be singing again in public with other people. Truly an exciting development as we get out of this dark, weird time. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Sarah.
That was Allie Way, who created the Choral Poetry Project at Mainline Theatre this weekend. And you were hearing some of the music from the show here, Fall Leaves Fall, adapted from an Emily Bronte poem. So beautiful. You can see this video and others on Allie's YouTube page. To learn more about her work, visit allieweigh.com. That's AllieWeigh.com. Or follow her on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Tickets and information for Choral Poetry Project at fringemontreal.ca. That wraps up today's show about the Fringe Festival. If you want to learn more about the fest and its history, please consider listening to the Fringe Buzz Lab, a bilingual podcast I'm co-hosting with the talented Véro Raymond. It really comes across as an oral history of the Fringe. A new episode is out today with Pat Donnelly of The Gazette and artists Mike Payette, Marie Barlizzo, and Julie Tamiko Manning. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcasts. Keywords are Lab Fringe Buzz. You have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Tonight you heard four Fringe artists. Storyteller Nisha Coleman of All Right, musician Allie Way of the Choral Poetry Project, and Justin Kalla and Julia Kennefic of The Space Between. A big thank you to my guests.
You can hear past episodes of Upstage at CKUT.ca under Archives. Thank you to Jack Soler, our new spoken word coordinator, for making sure this show gets to air. Welcome aboard, Jack. And thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah DeAy. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and CKUT.ca. Until next time, stay safe and happy fringing.
Did you get vaccinated?
Not yet, but I will soon.
And which one are you getting?
I'm getting the dance vaccine.
The dance vaccine? Great idea.
Yeah, rehearsing with the girls is what I miss the most.
Well, it's going to be the soccer vaccine for me. I can't wait to see the gang again.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID vaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.